Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Thanks so much, everyone, for being with us today. My next guest is Dr. Jerry Kornfeld. I'm excited to introduce him. Jerry runs something called Ask Dr. Jerry, and Ask Dr. Jerry presents longevity and health topics to Vistage Group's TV, cruise ships, boomers and seniors, and he has two hot topics we're going to talk about, living to 100 with quality, and Dr. Smartphone will see you now. So, Dr. Jerry, thanks very much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited about being on.
Well, excited to have you. Tell us a little bit about how you started Ask Dr. Jerry, and what is that all about?
Well, I've been in family practice in Southern California for many, many years. And during that period of time, I've had the opportunity to write a few books and do some television interviews. And during those television interviews, the questions kept on coming in from the staff, the crew, et cetera. And I kept on thinking, don't these folks have a doctor that can ask these questions of? And it turned out that there was just a great need for somebody to be available, not to practice medicine, not to diagnose or treat, but just to answer routine questions. You go to see a doctor, you come back, and your wife, your husband says, well, what did the doctor say? Well, you know, I forgot to ask him that. And so Ask Dr. Jerry started that way. And we had a television show here on our local television. We were with Regis Philbin when he first started his program in Southern California, AM Los Angeles, where we did all of those various segments. And we still routinely do them periodically at our local television station. Plus, I offer it to all of my audiences, the opportunity to not only ask me at the time I'm speaking, but to take my email address and I'm available to respond to them. Obviously not diagnosing and treating, but to routine questions. So that's the whole origin of why I am now asked Dr. Jerry.
If you were to graph out what the most common questions you get, what would they be?
Well, it depends upon the age of the audience, obviously, and it depends upon the demographic and the sexuality. But frequently on cruise ships, most of my audiences are female, so-called insurance widows, and so different questions. But obviously with the male audiences, heart disease is probably the most common thing because it is our number one, unfortunately, fatal disease. And so I wrote a book called Your 100-Year Heart, dedicated to the premise that our hearts are dying too young. I just got so frustrated seeing young men coming into the hospital with heart attacks when, in fact, heart disease, as my book clearly demonstrates, is in the majority of cases a preventable disease. And our lifestyle is the major contributor to why this is the number one fatal disease. And that statistic should be changed. It should not stand. And that was the motivation for writing the book. So that area is very, very common. People want to know about cholesterol and want to know about blood pressure and all those other factors. And, of course, with females, it's a little bit different. Even though heart disease is the number one killer of both men and women, with females, menopause at the boomer age also is a very common question.
So the fact that we just don't take responsibility for our lifestyles and how we care for our gift of our bodies, it's our own fault?
Absolutely. Bill, let me tell you, that got me into my new hot topic, which is living to 100 with quality. There's no question our lifestyle is the major factor in the majority of ailments that we have. And we used to think that our longevity was based 100% upon our genes. If we had family who lived to 80 or 90, the good chances we were. Well, that was true up until about a generation or so ago, and our lifestyle has so drastically changed because we spend most of our time sitting in front of our computer or in front of our television or sitting in our car. And what was true 100 years ago, when our body did most of the activities for us by walking or lifting or whatever, we have changed our lifestyle drastically. And so we now say that genes probably accounts for 20 to 30% of your longevity, but you can alter your genes. Genes are a DNA and a protein and a DNA, and you literally can alter your genes with your lifestyle. And we have significant evidence now, long studies to demonstrate that being valid.
So if you were to have that typical person who's asking about heart disease and say, you can start this today. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. If you're going to live to have a 100-year heart, here are the three top things you need to do. What would they be?
Well, I have a list of about 10 things, I say, pleasurable things that obviously one has to do. But if I was just to give you one or two, I would say right on top of the list is exercise. Absolutely no question, our lifestyle has to include exercise. Unfortunately, most of us, when we hear the word exercise, get turned off because we think of the negative aspects. Well, I don't have time to join a gym. Gyms are too expensive. It's just too. I'm not comfortable joining a gym. I can't become a marathon runner at my age. I mean, all those statements are just rationalizations. First of all, most important, get it straight. You don't have to join a gym. When I say exercise, all the studies from the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, clearly indicate walking is the absolute best tool for exercise. A 30-minute walk a day, a minimum of 5 days a week, will satisfy the exercise criteria. Now, I'm not talking walking and strolling and looking at the stars. I'm talking about a brisk walk. And people say, what is a brisk walk? I say, well, have you ever been late for an appointment or late for work? Walk as if you're late for an appointment. That's a brisk walk. That's, that is absolutely number one. Number two, the foods you put in your body. We, unfortunately, don't pay much attention to advice about food because we are so programmed to like things. I give the analogy that if you just got a brand new Ferrari and you paid $150,000 for it, and all of a sudden you have a pinging in your motor and you go to the mechanic, and the mechanic says, well, you know, using that cheap gas, it's going to kill your motor. I guarantee you'll never again in your life put that gas in that car. But if you come to me with chest pain and I talk to you about your lifestyle and I talk to you about the foods you're putting in your body and I tell you not to do that, you leave my office and say, yeah, I got to cut that out. Until you go to the restaurant with your friends and you are having a couple of drinks and feeling good and forget about the food, you just never enjoy yourself. And so we ignore that advice, and that's number two. And number three, if I were to give you three, would be attitude. There's just no question, your attitude controls your destiny. Every time I've seen a patient who's had a problem, who does not do well, I think of other patients who had the same problem at the same age and treated with the same medication who did do well. And I look to see why. And guess what? The why is those who had a positive attitude, those who are not sitting around all day complaining about their illness, always got better faster. So exercise, the foods you put in your body and your attitude, I would give you a three.
Excellent, excellent. So let's talk about the patient-doctor relationship and how it's being changed by the smartphone and medical apps. Do you think that that's going to damage the relationship between patients and doctors, and why so?
There's absolutely no question in my mind that the patient-doctor relationship is an integral part of how you react and how you do. For many years, I'm a faculty member of the UCLA Medical School. And for many years, I taught freshman medical students a class called doctoring, which we taught them the art of communicating with their patients. Because we feel strongly, if your patient likes you, if you have a good relationship with your patient, they are going to do better. You may have had this experience or heard people say, you know what, I went to see this doctor, but I don't trust that guy. I don't think he knows what he's doing. You're not going to take the medicine, you're not going to follow his advice, and you're not going to do well. But if you like your doctor and have a relationship and feel comfortable with your doctor, you're absolutely going to do better. So doctor-patient relationships, to me, are an integral part of my specialty of family medicine, and I think of any relationship between a doctor. So it's going to have an effect. Right now, economics is a major factor in the practice of medicine. And doctors are being harassed to get patients in and out because of the cost. As a matter of fact, a word that was very common, or still very common, in the business world, productivity. I never thought I'd hear that word come into the medical world, but it is now in the medical world. Doctors are being penalized because they are not being productive enough. If a doctor, and this is a classic story. When I asked somebody when they first described to me productivity, I said, what do you mean? They said, so if a patient comes into your office and it's a revisit, in other words, you've seen them, they're coming back now for a checkup. And based upon the diagnosis, you'll be allowed a certain amount of time. So the patient's back for a revisit, and the diagnosis is whatever, you're allowed 5 minutes. And if you go 10 minutes, you're going to be penalized. And penalty means it'll come off of your income. If you go 3 minutes, you're going to be rewarded. Well, that's impossible. Somebody comes back into my office after I treated them. What happens if the medicine didn't work? What happens if they had a reaction to the medication? What happens if they develop another symptom? And all these things are intangibles. If it's black and white, they walk in and they're better, the medicine worked, and they're cured, no problem. But that doesn't happen very often. So productivity and Dr. Smartphone, meaning your smartphone now is right now in this whole world called telemedicine, diagnosing and treating on the computer. There is no hands-on by a doctor. You're at home, and it's interesting because I've done this talk to several distance groups, and I've got different reactions based upon the age of the group. Those, and it's not often that my distance audience has CEOs who are in their 30s. I guess most of the CEOs are in their 50s. But in any event, I did this talk, and the group was very young CEOs. And when I got done with the talk, they thought there was nothing wrong with it. They loved the idea that they didn't have to leave their house. And many people listening to this may also say, yeah, that's great. I don't have to make an appointment for a doctor. I don't have to sit in the doctor's office for 2 hours. I don't have to go through a whole harassment. From my home, I can get treated. Well, that's good for about 80% of the illnesses that we have, because about 80% of the things that go into a doctor's office will get better generally, no matter what you do. So I always tell my audiences, anybody going to practice of medicine and have an 8 out of 10 track record that people are going to get better is pretty good. But you go to medical school, and I tell this to my students, you go to medical school to diagnose and treat the 20% who have significant illnesses that need your skills. And so that what's going to happen to the 20% when the computer hears your symptoms and it's going to go through a list of differential diagnoses, which is what I, as a trained physician, did in my brain. My computer, my brain, made the differential diagnosis. But the computer is going to do it. It's going to come up with a list of potential diagnoses based upon your symptoms. And then based upon that list, tests may be ordered. And based upon the results of those tests, medicine will be prescribed. And if you do get to talk to somebody about what's going on, it may not be a physician. And that's what's going on today. And so I am very concerned, even though many people in the audience may not be. And I've heard this argument. Well, I know. I think it's good that the computer probably knows more than the doctor. And so there's a big, big battle going on. And I think what has been traditional for the practice of medicine for centuries is going to be eliminated. And I'm very unhappy about that.
So it just ruins that whole the potential for misdiagnosis is great at that point where it might matter the most, because, like you said, 8 out of 10 of them are going to say, take 2 Tylenol and visit me back
exactly.
in the morning. You know, no problem. But it's that
exactly.
2 out of 10 that really could be life changing, and they're not going to get that kind of the potential for mistakes is there. 2 out of 10 is really, you know, 200,000 out of a million over a course of a short period of time, I'm sure.
But it's your life. It's 100%, and that's the thing. That's why, as I said, that's why we go to medical school, to be able to diagnose those other illnesses. Majority of people who come into my office or any doctor's office in primary care are there with thought-related illnesses: backaches, headaches, stomach aches, skin rashes, blood pressure problems. I mean, a lot of these things are not very complicated, and you don't have to go through 8 to 10 years of formal medical education to deal with them. The whole concept really developed from the military with the medic, and that's a very valuable concept because there's a need for the medic in the military. And the medics, and I was a medic before I went to medical school, so I know that experience. Medics take care of a lot of people, but most of the stuff they take care of is routine. And so nobody's thinking about the 20%. They're thinking about the routine. That you really, I mean, I could take anybody and give them 6 months of training, and they can go into an office and take care of most of the people that come in, but not the 20%.
Yeah, what if they hear something? You know, not everybody is perfect with their recollection of symptoms as well. And so a good doctor can figure out, hey, you know, something else is not right here. You know, there's something about that. So from a doctor's perspective, if these things are taking away that 80%, isn't some of that, I mean, does as a family practitioner or a GP, for instance, doesn't that impact your income if patient flow is diminished to a small, is it worth it to be a doctor, I guess, at that point?
Okay, what's happening, as I said, the economics, what's happening is that many doctors are hiring non-doctors because economically it's much less expensive to hire a physician's assistant as opposed to hiring an MD. Physician's assistant may hire it in at $80,000 a year. An MD obviously would be higher than that. So the laws have specifically identified how many physician's assistants a doctor can have in his office, and he allegedly is supposed to supervise them. But now the laws are changing, and they're allowing a lot of non-physicians to practice without a physician supervising them. And so if a physician hires three or four physician's assistants, paying them less and seeing those patients, what's going to happen is income is going to go up because they have that much more volume because he's got that many more people seeing patients. So the economics from the perspective of cutting down on the physicians and increasing that can have an economic positive effect in a busy physician's office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's turn the page on that and talk about living to 100, because that's your book is your 100-year heart. And
right.
What makes you think that living to 100 is on the horizon?
We are right now, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I think this topic is unbelievable. The opportunity that we are experiencing, most people just don't realize. And I'm doing that right now. I'm on the lecture circuit right now, speaking to boomer and senior groups wherever I can to tell them that our culture has taught us that when we reach our 65th birthday, that it's time to sit in a chair and stop. I cannot tell you how many years I've heard patients say, well, I can hardly wait 5 years, I can retire. I mean, that's so sad. They spent their lives waiting to retire. The whole concept of aging is going through a major, major change because in the past 100 years, we have almost doubled our lifespan. And people don't think about that. So if we have doubled our lifespan, almost doubled our lifespan in the past 100 years, we went from about 40-something up to late 70s. If you think about what the potential is, why cannot we live to 100 or 150? As a result, many major medical centers around the world, and Cambridge in England is one of the primary ones, have developed programs. And they have a very interesting opening line in their program. And I use this in all of my talks because it stimulates a reaction. And your reaction will be interesting also. The opening line is, the first person to live to 1,000 was just born. Now, how do you react
wow.
to that?
Wow.
How do you
to
react
1,
to that?
To 1,000. Wow.
Yeah, to 1,000 was just born.
With disbelief, I guess, incredible disbelief. A hundred seemed like a long time, but 1,000? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, well, everybody said, yeah, it's impossible. It never happened. I said, how do you know what happened? Why is it that we have accepted, and this is what the researchers are looking into, why is it that we have accepted that death is inevitable? You know, death and taxes are inevitable. There are animals that don't die. Salamanders can regenerate all of their body parts and tissues. Why? And DNA, by the way, of all living things, plants, animals, humans, is 99% the same. The 1% difference in the DNA is what separates us from each other species. So why cannot man do that? And that's what they're looking at. And to make it more exciting, and the reason I'm so excited about this, is because Silicon Valley billionaires, you know, the young guys who have sold their tech companies for hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, well, a significant percentage of them, many of the real big names, are putting hundreds of millions of dollars into this whole project of increasing lifespan. And they're looking at the relationship that our cells have and why do the cells die. And they're coming up with some fantastically exciting things. Obviously, the motivation is not to die. And they're saying, why do we have to die? And nobody ever really asked that question until all this money started pouring into it. So the reason I'm so excited about it now is that there literally are billions of dollars coming from these Silicon Valley billionaires into this whole world of extending lifespan. And there's some interesting things I can tell you about that they're finding out. How does that sound to you?
Well, we can certainly, you know, when I think about it, I think we can certainly eradicate disease. We can take away, and we have taken away, many of the things that would normally have done us in early. Economically, it's a tough one because we're set up for people to kind of stop being productive and earning income at a certain age. That, and again, it's our mindset. You're right. It was age 65 was Otto von Bismarck, in the, you know, the Prussian who set 65 as the normal retirement age back when life expectancy was mid 40s, you know, 50 years old, many years ago. So it's a mindset. It's a mindset, and it would require a lot of retooling. But I guess you know, physically, what is a 200-year-old person? We see 100-year-old people under the circumstances they've lived through. What will they look like, do you think? I mean,
those are all very interesting questions.
Well, let me give you one more viewpoint. I tell people today, 65 is the new 55. We've all heard that. 75 is the new 65, but 80 still looks like 80.
No, 80 is the new 60. Okay. You've got to start thinking about the brain and the body, and the brain controls the body. Your thoughts, your attitude become negative when you start reaching the elderly age. And we still refer to 55 as the beginning of elderly, by the way, which is absurd. But the physical appearances, the cell deterioration, a significant amount of that is coming because of your behavior and your attitude. Woe is me. It's all over. I don't have anything to look forward to. I'm going to stop. And how often, I don't know if you ever heard this, but how often the statement has been made by kids to their parents, hey, Dad, you know, at your age, you really shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
That's nonsense. I tell people, never let the two numbers after your name control your destiny, your physical and mental condition. But the two numbers are irrelevant. And I show pictures of people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, 100s, winning marathons, winning medals, breaking new world records. I've got a lady who's 86 who is a gymnast. I've got a gentleman who's 101 who rides bicycles for France and just won a big race. They're all over the place. Those are the people who have not accepted the numbers as the end of their lifestyle. If you accept them, your cells are going to deteriorate. Let me just throw in one other thing, because this is really one of the exciting pieces of research. Something called telomeres. Have you ever heard that word?
No,
telomeres.
I haven't.
Okay. Well, not many people have. And it's come because of this research. It turns out, on the tip of our chromosomes, you know, we have 23 pair of chromosomes, which because of the technology we've identified, and each one of those chromosomes on their tip have this cap. And I describe the cap as if on your shoelaces, on your tennis shoes, you have this white plastic tip, that cap.
Uh-huh.
Well,
okay.
On the tip of your chromosomes, you know, the chromosomes, the X and the Y, the male and female, those chromosomes have your DNA and they control your destiny. Well, it turns out those chromosomes with their telomeres are the key factors. They have done the research to identify that the length of the telomere, and this is all documented, you could look all this up, the length of the telomeres controls the longevity of the cell. And as the cells start to age, the telomeres are shortening. So shortening of telomeres are related to aging and death of a cell. And they have done some fantastic research at the University of California in San Francisco, looking at those who have a positive lifestyle, who live longer, and have been able to evaluate length of telomeres, and lifestyle literally prevents telomeres from shrinking. That is fantastic.
Wow.
You know, I say to
that
people,
that is fantastic.
Yeah, that's the kind of research that's going on. Looking how to keep your telomeres longer. It's not yet something that you go to your doctor's office and get your telomeres measured. It's all the research environment, but that research. So if you look up TELE, telomeres, it's unbelievable what's going on because of all this billions of dollars coming into this area.
Well, Dr. Jerry, it's a fantastic information. Very, very enlightening. We're out of time today, but I want to have you back and talk more about this because it is fantastic and very interesting. Tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, though, and let's close with that.
Okay, my email address is KJBK, K is in Kornfeld, K, KJBKORN, KJBKORN at AOL. And I'm certainly available to answer questions at all times. My website's in the process of being redone, but it's Ask Doctor, spell out Doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, Ask Dr. Jerry. My profile is on LinkedIn and all the other places when you Google my name.
And again, Dr. Jerry's book is Your 100-Year Heart, and he is certainly available. If you're a Vistage chairperson or another business group leader, give him a call. He's obviously a fascinating speaker, someone that you'd want to have talk to your group. So, Dr. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. Very fascinating, and I look forward to the next time we talk.
Thank you. The book's on Google also, by the way, and Amazon. The book's on Amazon also.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to it next time.
Thank you. Bye.
We're going to call it a day for our show today. Thank you very much for joining us. Tomorrow, join us again. We have a three-hour show planned with 9 professional advisors, authors, and thought leaders. We're here for you, our private business owners, so that you can be well-planned. Please join us again sometime soon. Thank you.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.